coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duralde. Today, we are joined by producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Hi, Alonzo.
Hi.
What's good with me is Naked and Afraid.
Oh.
So I was super into the show a couple years. Basically, as soon as I found out it wasn't a dating show, because I heard that title and was like, boo, boo.
Because that's how you do your dates.
Yes. Yeah. Don't, you know, put it on the internet. That's fine. I'm cool with that. But it's a really interesting practice. It's every episode takes a man and a woman, puts them in the wilderness. They're both survivalists. And to me, it's this fascinating watch of just a microcosm of gender roles and breaking those down. Because it's often like an ex-military guy and then a woman who can like out hunt him any day of the week and him sort of having to acquiesce to that along the way. And this week, why it made the list finally is because my interests collided, and one of the participants on the episode called Honduran Hell is is this amazing dog musher who lives in Wisconsin. His name is Quince Mountain, and his partner and wife raced the Iditarod last year, and I follow her. Her name is Blair Braverman. She's an amazing Twitter account with all their dogs. But he was also the first trans participant they had that participated as an out trans survivalist.
Whoa.
And I thought it was great. He was very forthcoming about it, but it was also very nonchalant. His writing and sort of live tweeting about it on Facebook or on Twitter, combined with the show itself and how he kicked ass. Like, it's really nightmare scenarios. So, yes, Naked and Afraid with Quince Mountain. You can watch it. If you don't have cable, like, it's on, you know, where people rent, like, on iTunes and things like that. But
I got to say, Quince Mountain does sound like a particularly delicious brand of marmalade.
Yes. He has a very delicious marmalade vibe to him.
Well, okay.
Yeah. No, I'm a big fan. So right. Check him out.
Well, we have a special guest today. She's one of the hosts of Maximum Fun's Everything's Coming Up Simpsons, which I was delighted to go on a few months back. And now she's here. Please welcome writer and comedian Julia Prescott.
Hi.
Julia, what's good?
What's good is the Americana at Brand Memes Twitter account.
Oh my God, I saw that.
Have you seen that?
Yes.
I don't know how long it's been up, but I feel like it's been up for a little while and I'm kind of late to the game, but it is bringing me so much joy in my daily life, in my work week,
walk
in everything.
It.
It's so specific.
It's very specific to people who live in Los Angeles, specifically the Valley, specifically Glendale, and or I guess wherever the Grove is, because they stretch it out. It is taking mall culture into a meme territory that speaks to my heart directly. For example, there was a image recently of like some promo photo for Toy Story 4, and it was of Tom Hanks and Tim Allen, and they labeled over Tom Hanks Americana, Tim Allen Glendale Galleria.
Ooh.
Enough said. It's very Americana specific leaning, which is something that I mean, let me be real. Last April with my husband, we went on our like first marriage anniversary trip to Paris, the most romantic city in the world. And then as we were nearing toward the end of our trip, I turned to him and said, "I can't wait to go home and go to the Americana." Now, wasn't a joke. It was made even more absurd by the fact that the Americana is vaguely inspired by Paris.
True,
yes. In that very chintzy, like, you know, airport gift shop kind of way. It's like Paris if somebody has never seen Paris and has only been described to it through, like, Savage Garden songs.
If you've gone to the movies lately and you've seen that stupid ad where all the people talk about the SUV and how lovely it is and how the designer should get a gold star. That's shot at the Americana
baby.
That's what the Americana looks like.
It, to me, I mean, it is the only news I care about currently because they will also post photos of like new storefronts because there's always a new storefront in the Americana. Mm. It's a bustling city of its own.
And if you're not familiar with it, it is set up. Like when you talk about the Paris stylings, it's set up as if it's a little city of itself.
It's a
mall always
town.
Feels like being on a back lot. Town. Yeah.
It is very much like
that.
There's
a huge fountain in the middle. And
It is. I don't know, actually, if mall towns are unique to Los Angeles. It feels like in something that we've at least adopted as our own. So the Americana, the same developer, also did the Grove. And now they're building a new one in North Hollywood, where I'm from. So they're coming to my hometown. It speaks to me on multiple levels. I love a mall. And I love a themed immersive experience.
We may not be the only ones who do it, but I suspect we do it better than anyone
we
else.
We do it better than anyone else.
We're for sure the only ones that do it.
Yeah. I love it so much. You could also live the Americana if you dared. I vaguely kind of know somebody who does. One time I was at the Americana and I looked around at all the apartments surrounding the Americana and I counted 5 different acoustic guitars on different porches. So that's kind, just to give you an idea. Another part about the Americana at Brand Memes Twitter account, I retweeted it recently and a friend of mine reached out the moment I retweeted.
And said, are you okay?
No. Said, wow, I this whole time thought this was you. And I've never received a better compliment in my life. Honestly, better than my IMDb credits and star meter.
Yes, good.
So that's what's good with me.
Nice. Those are very good. Alonzo, what's good with you?
I'm so glad you asked, Rhea. So McDonald's is doing this thing where apparently they are offering treats from international McDonald's, like stuff that is popular in other countries, they are making available for a limited time in the United States. And the one I'm most excited about, because I can't stop saying it, is the Stroopwafel McFlurry.
Oh my God! Woo! They're bringing the Stroopwafel here.
Yes, which is also the name
family
of my
favorite
industrial noise band. I have not had a Stroopwafel McFlurry yet, but I'm gonna have a Stroopwafel McFlurry real soon.
Are they gonna be at every location, or is it one of those things like we're trying them out and it's just in like?
There's a big page about it. There's a big page about it on the website, so I'm hoping it's not just like
a
regional thing.
Right.
Yeah. So like apparently in Spain they have some like burger that has bacon and Thousand Island dressing on it that's real popular. There's some Canadian thing, and there's one from somewhere else, Australia, I think. But yeah, the Netherlands gave us, of course, the Stroopwafel McFlurry. So
that's very cool.
I really want a McDonald's poutine, you guys. Can you imagine?
Over those fries.
Oh, right.
Because poutine normally doesn't have thin fries like that.
No, they
right?
have like a steak fries. I don't like a steak fry. Like,
yeah, it's too much potato.
Yeah, McDonald's is, you know, the gold standard, the gold arch standard of fries.
Go. Yeah, well.
That's a good one.
Maybe next year. We'll see.
Yeah.
Hey, today we're going to be talking about Men in Black International. We've got a call from the Who Shot Line, and as always, we've got staff picks. But first of all, it's time for In a Dick, our news segment. Of course, that is short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer those important questions. Is this important? Do I care? And Drea's going to kick us off.
I am, and I have such a good one. You all in this room are familiar, so I'm not going to blow your mind, but I maybe will catch some people in the outer world. Did you guys know our dear April Wolf is co-writing the new Black Christmas remake that's coming out from Blumhouse this winter?
I'm sorry, who? What?
Ms. April Saucy Wolf.
Oh.
April Tits to the Glass Wolf.
It's not what happens in a movie, it's how
it
happens.
It's how it happens, April Wolf. Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
And it's being directed by Sophia Tikal, who's amazing. Blumhouse is producing. They also did Get Out and Paranormal Activity, as well as the recent Halloween remake, if you're not familiar with the name of production companies. and it's very exciting. And if you're not familiar either with the original Black Christmas, it's one of my very first favorite horror films, and it also, I think, could be one of the originators of the call is coming from inside the house. So
oh, wow.
big fan. It takes place at a sorority house. So I don't know too on top of all of this. Maybe the title Black Christmas gave it away. It is a Christmas movie.
What?
Maybe Alonso picked up on that. So is this important? Do you care?
Well, duh.
Duh.
Obviously. I mean, even though, as the Smiths pointed out, we hate it when our friends become successful. no, very exciting for Ms. Wolf. And yeah, given that there has already been a Black Christmas remake and it
yes.
kind of sucked,
yes.
I think the field is open.
Yeah.
You know, they could really, like, fix the rep on that one. But yeah, the original Black Christmas, interesting in several ways. First of all, directed by Bob Clark, who would later make another holiday classic called A Christmas Story. The two could not be any more different. And yeah, it did invent The Call is Coming from Inside the House, but it also kind of invented the slasher genre.
Yeah.
Like, really, we had, there was Psycho and Peeping Tom, and then later we'd get Halloween, but this movie really kind of sets a lot of the rules in place, and it's tied to a holiday. So even though Halloween led to Friday the 13th and My Bloody Valentine and all the the Happy Birthday to Me, all the holiday specific mm-hmm. slasher movies, Black Christmas was there first.
It also feels like the first Twisted Christmas kind of movie too.
Yes, I believe
my
you are
history
right.
is not super sharp with that one, but it feels like it because it was from originally in the 70s.
Early 70s.
Oh,
or I think 74.
Early 70s,
I think
really?
Yeah, and in fact, actually, when it was originally released in the United States, I think under the name Silent Night, Evil Night, because they thought that people would think that it was a movie about black people.
Yeah.
Oh, God forbid.
Joke's on them. It's Canadian.
Joke's on them. What? Because there's no black people in Canada?
None.
Yeah.
There was Drake, and he's here now.
He's here now. No, he's still celebrating the Raptors win. Sports reference. Who shot ya?
Time stamping the podcast.
The other thing with Black Christmas that I loved is if you go back, not it's set in a sorority, but unlike the peep show quality of a lot of, especially horror films, but anything really that looks at women of college age.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The female characters in that have a remarkable amount of agency and wits to them, some of them.
Yes.
And I am so excited in the hands of April and Sophia to take that and elevate what's right there in terms of a kind of feminist take on it or a female forward take mm-hmm. on that kind of story.
I look forward to all of its Wolfian touches.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes you see a headline and you just go, this makes the most sense out of anything in mm-hmm. the entire world. And, often that is somebody you do not know, but it's extra special when it's somebody that you do. And so I really cannot wait to see what April does with that.
Yeah. So there's already a teaser poster out and it is set to come out Friday the 13th. Of December.
Oh,
so good.
My God. What,
so good.
What luck that there's a
I
Friday
know,
the 13th.
Right?
Damn, what a swish moment that was. The studio realized that.
They got psyched. Yeah, for sure.
Speaking of projects I'm super excited about, if there are any fans of the Spice Girls out there, you may have heard, the Hollywood Reporter has announced that Paramount Animation is working on an animated musical that will feature all of the original Spice Girls going on a brand new adventure. The film will include some of their classic hits along with new songs. According to Paramount Animation president Maria Soria, the Spice Girls had an idea that we've been developing. They are very involved. No word yet on whether or not this is a direct sequel to Spice World. Is this important? Do you care? And don't answer wrong.
How about I don't think it's important, but I care?
I'll accept
okay.
this.
Okay.
I'm going to echo that as well. I mean, I was a big fan of Spice World, but then
sure.
again, I was slumber party age when it came out. So
see,
it was
I wasn't.
Big for me.
And I still
Alonso
loved it.
Does not have that excuse.
Well,
but
you know
he
what?
Stands by
it. My appreciation for it deepened as I grew up and I started watching the Beatles movies and realized the obvious references that
sure.
they were making stylistically
True.
With that movie. And all of it made so much more sense and it made me appreciate it way more.
When you got that Elvis Costello was the bartender?
Yes, absolutely. who didn't? I'm just curious what story they're going to go on. Is it going to be a bunch of of, you know, hijinks across London, or are they going to go to space? I don't know.
They basically did so much bonkers stuff in Spice World that an animated project makes more sense.
Yeah, like it's like, the only place they have to go left to go.
Right, because nothing in Spice World feels real grounded in reality.
No.
Like the bus alone that I love that we talked about the dimensions of it. It would be like a 40-foot by 90-foot.
It's a TARDIS.
Yeah,
that's
it's
one of
a
my
total
favorite
TARDIS.
Gags. And actually, one of the shows that I worked on early on in writing the Aquabat Super Show had the same exact gag where their battle tram looked like a normal, you know, like tour bus. And then inside it was like, there was a lab. And I mean, the monkeys did this too, and the Beatles did this too. But I just love that silly gag. I think it really is a good tone setter.
But that's a good point because most of the things, the bands that we've seen do this before have been all men. And there's something about the Spice Girls have welcomed their own camp aesthetic from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so I hope they lean into that with this.
Well, you know, this is a band where they turned all of themselves into characters.
Yes, yeah.
Like
exactly.
They're all walking tropes, you know. So, yeah, that's like half your work is already done.
Yeah, it reminds me of...
You think baby is a trope? Just kidding. I couldn't even get the full level of sarcasm I wanted. This mic can't contain my level
you
of
knew
sarcasm.
In your heart. Yeah.
It was just dripping all over. Yeah. You're in the splash zone now.
It's like being at a Gallagher show.
Well, I was going to say that, like, for the pop stars, the modern pop stars that I would say get it right are the ones that embrace that kind of characterization of what a pop star is. And I feel like, you know, the best example we have currently is Miley Cyrus, sort of just, even in the way that she announced her latest album, she is coming, and she had all of these, you know, different videos on her Instagram that, like, were playing with, like, who is she? You know, I don't know. It may seem overly simple, but it worked for me, and I love that she embraces that camp side of her, too, much like the Spice Girls.
Yep. Ah, oh, but they've done it for so much longer.
They walked so Miley could run.
They've been holding that torch and they continue to shine.
They walked in 6-inch wedgie heels.
So Miley could run.
I feel like this is also connected to the recent story, and I only saw the quote from Ginger Spice, Jerry Halliwell, saying like, she apologized for leaving the band in like such a casual way. Like, I think she said it like, I was just going through a silly thing at the time. Sorry, girls. You know, like, it just was so like something that you'd write in a text. It was very laughable. Because I remember at the time it was heartbreaking.
Oh, totally.
Oh devastating.
Betrayal.
So here's some news about somebody and now something we hope you'll really like. Dee Reese is set to direct the new musical fantasy called The Kids' Exquisite Follies. Reese, most famous for directing Mudbound and Pariah, wrote the script and is said to have been inspired by, quote, the Afro-punk and steam-funk scenes, and want to reimagine the whole Follies genre for today, lift it out of the problematic tropes of the past, and invest it with a queer, edgy energy. I don't know what any of that means, but I think it sounds great. Santa Gold is set to compose the music, with Lucasfilm's Industrial Light and Magic creating the film's visual effects. And if you're a person who isn't a fan of musicals, Ricky Carmona, Reese had this to say about the inspiration behind the film. My favorite musical as a kid growing up was The Wiz, but ironically, I generally hated musicals, which is why I wanted to take this on and write something original to try and do something unexpected with the form, make a musical for people who hate musicals. Is this important? Do you care?
I care so much. I think this is important because Dee is a fascinating directorial talent in that each of her choices seem completely disconnected from what she did previously. Mm. And I think a lot of directors tend to get pigeonholed, but certainly a queer female director, I could see every studio from now till the end of time being like, so we have this Orlando update, so we have this, do you know what I mean? Just wanting her to do very specific kind of films. And each time she's like, no, I'm going to catch you off your guard. And amazing. I love that. And I also love the inventiveness of this. Santa Gold, I'm a huge fan of. Like, she's got really cool music, really cool beats, and a very cool vibe to her. Mm-hmm. So I think they're a good pairing. And actually, I do really like the idea of confronting something like the Follies and head on looking at the problems and red flags of it and subverting them or reinventing them or whatever, rather than like, oh, I'm going to you know, make this whole new, why not improve something that so many people haven't been able to like fully embrace or enjoy because right. it does have so many problems.
Well, and you know, I'm kind of surprised that she to hear that she hates musicals because she did a really terrific musical biopic for HBO, yeah. the Bessie with Queen Latifah. As someone who loves musicals, I get a little gun shy when I hear a director. I'm making musicals for people who hate musicals,
right? Same.
But it's her, and I think you're right. She is visionary and unpredictable, and you know, I mean, in a way, maybe like this is the half of Bessie that isn't the half that was Mudbound, you know, in terms of you
that's
know, that,
a good point.
That
yeah.
was a period piece, and now this is the sort of musical Fantasia. But I'm down. I want to see how it goes. And I think it will, whatever she comes up with, it's not going to be boring.
Yeah, I hope. It sounds great, but that's the thing, too. Like, I really hope. I don't feel like this is going to be what's going to happen, but I really hope that it's not something that's like, the formula is like flawless. We've got Santa Claus, we've got this, we got that. Like all these yes. like very eye-catching elements to it. And then the end result is like muddied by yep. all of these different competing elements of right. style. So I'm hoping that, and I'm hoping also that it's not, and it sounds like it won't be as like a super, super mainstream thing that gets overnoted, that it still has maybe an edgy indie kind of
I feel
edge to it.
Her saying that she wants it to be invested with the queer, edgy energy tells me that her divining rod on this is in the right place.
Yes, yes, yes.
She's found a good true north.
She's putting that out there right up front.
Yeah.
And I love musicals. So yay. I just wanted to put that out there.
Me too.
Yeah, that people that love musicals are just pure of heart, okay? But there are bad musicals, just like there are bad movies. But you know, you got to give them a chance.
Absolutely.
Listen, I wept describing the power of music to my husband recently while listening to Dear Evan Hansen. So that's just where I'm operating from.
Okay.
Yeah.
got your number. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Men in Black International as soon as we hear from another show on the Maximum Fun Network.
Hello, listeners of Maximum Fun. I want to tell you about our newest podcast that tells you all about the truth of the flat Earth.
Have you been looking out over the horizon and you've been thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't look round. I've been lied to my whole life.
What is NASA doing with $52 million
a day? Come on. We explode the myths.
Just kidding. We're Oh No Ross and Carrie, and we investigate extraordinary claims.
That's right. We investigate extraordinary claims firsthand. We go undercover in fringe groups. We get alternative medicine treatments. And we hang out with people who have unusual beliefs, like flat earthers, 9/11 truthers.
We do ghost investigations. We've joined Scientology, and we got baptized in the Mormon church.
If it goes bump in the night, then so do we. Why don't you check out Oh No Ross and Carrie at MaximumFun.org?
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me today are
Drea Clark
and Julia Prescott.
Today we're talking about Men in Black International, and the script is telling me, Drea, could you please provide a haiku summarizing the plot of Men in Black International?
No.
Fair enough.
But I will give you the plot. No, see, I follow the rule of threes in comedy, and I think we've already done that three times.
Yes, this horse has been beaten.
And yes, also, I can't count well enough to do a haiku, so I'm just going to freestyle it.
Math is hard.
So, Men in Black International, you guys, are you on the edge of your seats? Good, just where I want you. It begins with, we have Tessa Thompson, who is a young upstart American who, as a young child, saw some sort of alien mishaps with her parents, remembered it always, very bright, very precocious, ended up finding her way to the Men in Black organization, weaseling into a spot. Once in, they sent her via Emma Thompson, top of the agency in America for some reason, to England, where she meets the biggest star of the organization, Christopher Hemsworth. And he's just rock and rolling around town. They kind of accidentally get partnered up. And when an alien in their care is killed, you guys, there might be a mole in the agency. There might. So then the two of them paired up, aliens, possible bad guys, race around the world, sort of, to weird sea house place. And you guys, they kind of get to the bottom of it. And you know what?
I think they covered it.
They make this look good.
Whoa.
That's Men in Black International.
Yeah, it is. Thoughts?
I would say that I just want to start out and say that writing a Men in Black is a tall order, guys. You know, imagine being assigned with the task to write a Men in Black. It's very hard. And on paper, as I mentioned previously with the musical we were just talking about, like, that musical sounds great. This plot on paper sounds great. Like, if you were to do another Men in Black, we're taking it international, baby. It's girl. She, you know, we've got a girl. We've got a guy. Wow.
Wall of Fury, wrestling picture.
Yeah, she finds them. Like, all of the elements on paper sound like they would work. And also, I still have a great amount of sympathy for the filmmakers in trying to make something like that become, you know, as electric as that first one, but mm-hmm. we're never going to have that first one again. We're never going to have Paris. And I found myself feeling fine about this movie-going experience, but I felt like one of the fundamental flaws of it was that it lacked a sense of fun that that first one did. And the most fun element that drew me back to that first one was honestly the font. I found myself going, oh, I love that font. What a fun font. And then the rest of the movie was just okay.
Oh, the Stop Making Sense Dr. Strangelove
yes.
font in the credits? Yes.
I very much enjoyed that.
My thing, when this started, I agree with you. I was excited on paper. And they also, that they had two leads with known chemistry. Like, yeah. Thor Ragnarok was so incredible. Largely, the two of them are great sparring partners. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of upped the ante of what to expect with this, which I guess films want, but I also don't want, like, my expectations. I'm like, I like a low expectation for
yes,
things.
Yes, yes. Especially with romance.
Yeah.
So that it defies it.
Well, when this started and we meet Tessa and she's like the audience surrogate, my first thought was, oh, she's so good at this in a way that we had recently discussed Detective Pikachu. Mm. And the lead kid in that I found very flat. And it wasn't until I saw Tessa, who's so engaging, who can hold the camera at any moment. It's like, oh, this is what you want from an audience surrogate.
Yeah.
The problem is once she's combined with Hemsworth, his character I found real kind of loosey-goosey, and it's sort of written into the script why his personality is either off-putting or disingenuous. But I also was thrown the whole time. Part of it, I was appreciative for the first three quarters of the fact that I'm like, oh, they're building like a genuine platonic working relationship.
Yeah.
What a nice... What a unique take on that. Normally you're like, oh, two very attractive people. Oh, they've already all admitted they don't have anyone in their lives. Like, how exciting.
Yeah.
And so I was...
When do they fall into each other's arms?
Well, no, I was in... Yes. And so when it seemed that they weren't doing that at all, and it was just these people like, oh, you're going to grow and respect each other's talent, which is what I want. And then there were a couple weird tweaks of that. And I was like, oh, the fact that you don't even have a handle on that... And then also don't have a handle on larger story. And also, there were a lot of places where I was enjoying it for the most part in a like, okay. But it kept falling short in ways for me.
I have friends who have studied screenwriting and they will come out of a movie and they'll like just immediately parse all of these like plot things or, you know, stuff that's either cliche or that doesn't make sense, whatever. And oftentimes I notice that if I am being otherwise engaged, I don't go there. I don't really parse that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, if you don't otherwise engage me, I start looking at all of it.
I know.
And this movie just to me felt like the ultimate plot is so sort of like... like a not good Columbo episode. Like,
yeah.
it, you know, I figured out who the bad person was immediately.
About 20
yes,
seconds
yes,
in.
Yes, yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And it was so perfunctory. And then they bring in the little CG alien voiced by Kumail Nanjiani, who has nothing particularly witty or entertaining or smart to say. And it felt like those movies where they're really desperate for a laugh, so they cut to the dog.
Mm-hmm. Except for Pawnee was hilarious. Yeah. I found him really funny. I love Kumail anyway.
Yeah, I enjoyed him being around.
Yeah,
I just felt like he was sort of repeating things that were already being said, or kind of doing the sort of obvious like eye rolly sidekick sort of things. And it was like the let's cut to the dog reaction, and that'll be a cheap laugh.
I would wager that he was a third draft add-in.
Quite possibly.
I think I'm being charitable.
The other thing I don't usually do is like dig into the how did this thing get made and what happened, but I was kind of, once the story started coming about how this thing got made and how it went off the rails, I was like, okay, tell me more. There's a big piece in the Hollywood Reporter this week. So you have Walter Parks and Laurie McDonald, who are part of like the Amblin Spielberg fold, and they produced the original films. And they had this script that apparently was edgy and smart and interesting, and it attracted F. Gary Gray as director, who, you know, I think when he is committed to something like Straight Outta Compton, or
The Negotiator, I thought was great.
That was fine. But I was gonna say Straight Outta Compton or Set It Off. Like, these are movies that feel passionate and he's really directed in. And then beyond that, he feels like sort of a pretty good sort of Hollywood journeyman. You know, the kind of guy who gets movies done well enough and on time and on budget and that sort of thing, but doesn't really have a stamp on the production. Mm-hmm. So he comes in, they get Hemsworth and Thompson, and then apparently Park starts going through and like hacking away at the script and rewriting it and taking out everything that made it interesting, to the point where then Hemsworth and Thompson start bringing in their own individual dialogue writers to like create characters for them because it's not in the script anymore. The more I read, the more I just thought, oh God, Hollywood, why?
What a chaotic way to make any piece of anything, you know, any piece of narrative fiction.
And this one's interesting because—
To make a shoe, like, I mean, oh my God. Anything, you know.
Well, and Parks was a producer on it, and he also was a producer on the first couple. And so who knows if he had done a similar sort of last minute rejigging of those and was able to hold that up as a, look— What my proven system here, what I do works.
Sure. And he did write Sneakers, so that, you know, that gives him a lot of mileage.
But the idea of that kind of energy on set, people in every department feel that. You're playing catch up constantly. And again, that the backbone of this story is, perfunctory is a great word for it. It is a very, have you ever seen Murder, She Wrote? Then you know the shape of this, like, mystery there on puzzling. Or I guess an office-placed one would be better. But the, because there is, like, the mole and the agency thing.
It's a lazy spy movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it's this thing of, I feel, again, in talking of having a divining rod in a project, if you're looking, your two assets here, the property is one, sure. Men in Black, we get it, and the wackiness of it, and there's something great of just the pitch of there's aliens living amongst us.
Yeah.
But the assets of having Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson at this point, with the proven track record they had, and not crafting things around that, instead, what they did was craft things around the property.
Yes. Which even for 2019, it's like, This is a franchise that has always been about the idea of immigration and about assimilation versus, you know, whatever. Like, there's a lot of there's a lot of subtext that you're able to draw from if you feel like it, and the early movies do. And so now we've reached a point where, like, immigration is a hotter topic than it's ever been, and apparently all of that got cut.
That's such a good point.
Yeah. I also feel like, I mean, I'm just thinking back to the early ones. There was so much fun and joy in, like, the new inventions that they made that were so specific to that world. And I guess you get a little bit of it, of like a trapdoor leading to a chute that gets them down to a club. But I felt like there was so much more joy in, like, that inventiveness with, like, you know, how they talk. I don't know. Even just like a talking dog. Like, was such a joy in
the
early ones.
The thing with that is, I could equate this to like Grease and Grease 2. Mm. You know how you would go, except for Grease 2 is a perfect movie.
Grease 2 is great.
Like, you know, you go through Grease and you're like, all right, we have a song about the cars. We have a song about the whatever. And then you go to Grease 2 and you're like, we have a song about the car. We have a song about sex.
Yeah.
And it's all that, but it just doesn't fit. I could go through Men in Black International and be like, sure, we didn't have the like pug or whatever that was, but we had the guy with the beard, and the beard was the nano. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, again, on paper, I felt like their checklist was all there, but the heart of it, and maybe it is. Maybe that first one, the Kismet, and they did not expect that film to be what it ended up being. Like, that thing was... But like,
for example, that first film has the really cool art direction thing of like, we're going to be in the old TWA terminal and we're going to mix like high tech with very sort of mid-century modern stuff. And then in this movie, they trot it out a little bit, like there's a watch, you know, and there's a few things that sort of fit that. But they don't come up with a, wow, it's, you know, what, 25 years later, what's another equivalent of a clash between styles that we could do that would be that interesting that no one even is really trying at this point.
Yeah, I felt like the Kingsman movies do a better job at that kind of stuff.
You're
which
right.
I know we're talking spy movies now, but that is such a great example of like absurding up a James Bond type world. In a really fun way. I also just makes me think, I mean, I know nothing can ever touch that first one, but think about the Vincent D'Onofrio villain and like how crazy looking he was and how instantly terrifying but also intriguing he was. I felt like the villains that we have, the alien villains that we're following, like, yes, cool, I guess, on paper. Like, it to me felt like
Rebecca Ferguson had a third arm.
Yeah.
There's no way that can compare to Vincent D'Onofrio's
so
super
too.
Weirdo bug-infested human
Sugar.
Suit.
Yes, yeah.
Sugar.
But also, like, the two eyeless monsters that we're kind of following throughout the movie. I felt like like a cool design, I guess. But it was one of those things where, like, if I was the studio exec and, like, somebody pitched me, like, yeah, and then there are these eyeless monsters and this and that happens, I'm like... Fine, I'm so tired, man. I gotta get home.
Fun fact, when the first guy shows up on screen and he's like a janitor or he's working at the restaurant or something, I couldn't help myself. I leaned over and I was like, oh, he's a twin. There's going to be two of him. because they're Beyonce's backup dancers.
Oh,
it's Les Twins.
I
love them. Like, look at them at Google. They're incredible dancers.
Yeah.
But it was the most, I heard myself.
Were they
like,
the Bugaboos
how
in
cool
Homecoming?
Are you? They had their own twin, like,
good.
Showcase moment. But no, I truly was like, oh, there's going to be two of them.
Right.
And then there was.
Yeah, all of it is like fine. That's the thing. It's like
but
all of these
right,
ideas
because,
are fine.
But also the thing with those guys, there was no, when you have enemies that are insurmountable, like that their energy, right? Essentially, when they came back to their primal form or something. So they didn't even, the men in black that we were following didn't even get to be the ones to vanquish them.
Yeah.
They were just energy that was gone. So it's that, like, this tepid setup of, like, why do a creature creation if there's not a cool reveal or a way to manipulate it?
Exactly. Right. And why do a creature creation where the main characters aren't even clocking that is a terror and are going, we got to double down
because
these motherfuckers are going to go. They didn't even register that at all. They didn't even care. They were like, we got to go to Italy.
I guess.
And then get distracted by her crazy hair.
Jeez.
I was very like, this
I mean,
is too
I hated
much.
Her wig so much.
I hated her wig.
I had a lot of thoughts about that wig.
Of course, now going back though to this Hollywood Reporter piece, this is a troubled production. And I'm wondering, like, what is the history of troubled productions in terms of, do they ever come out well? Or should the trouble be enough to, like, cut bait?
Well, something we talked about, which has been like the world's, still the longest middle finger to you. You called me a troubled production, which is Titanic.
Sure.
Yes.
Which had like a year of bad press leading up to it. Like they had flood. They were shooting in Rosarito. They had floods. They had damages. They had casting. They had all these bad reports coming from set.
It was a movie called Titanic.
It was called Titanic. It was like 3 hours, 18 hours long, somewhere in that range. And then that movie is... Still, did it finally lose?
Oh, I think Avatar actually outgrossed it, but it is one of the biggest
like,
earners ever. You know?
25 whatever years later, like to me, that James Cameron's like cloak of smugness is mostly sewn out of.
Yeah, that's what they call June Bloom in Los Angeles.
Yes.
That's what is invading our homes every morning. I know, the smug with the Prius.
But I don't know. I think a lot of times, though, the crazy thing about the troubled production is that it's the Lady Macbeth thing. Mm-hmm. By the time you're hearing how troubled it is, they've already spent so much money on it that they can't stop.
Yeah, the only way out is through.
Yeah,
I think at that point
they just gotta keep it going. And yeah, you're right. Every so often you get a Titanic or a movie where it turns out that it all comes together anyway, or through just like spit and chewing gum, they manage to hold the thing together. But then other times, you know, they are indeed actual fiascos.
Other times they make Cleopatra.
For instance, yeah, a very famously troubled production. I was just thinking about, I remember living in Los Angeles in the early 90s, and the LA Times constantly updating everybody on the saga of James Brooks's I'll Do Anything. Remember that one?
No.
The movie that he did that was supposed to be a musical, but then it wasn't a musical because test audiences hated the music, and so it all got cut out. And it's Nick Nolte and Albert Brooks and Julie Kavner. The music that was cut, by the way, was written by Prince.
Shut
what?
Up.
Yeah. This is a legendarily cuckoo bananas production that just went south. And ironically, a lot of the movie is about movie testing. Like Julie Kavner plays a character who runs a company that does testing
for
films.
That is asking for it.
And Albert Brooks is a studio exec. So yeah, so I just remember like that for a year before that movie came out, you just kept reading about how they screened in Thousand Oaks last night, it didn't go well, and you know, and all this kind of thing. So that one I always think about is the trouble production. Another famous one from the 60s is Hello Dolly.
Hello Dolly was trouble?
Huge trouble, yeah, because it was like really expensive, really elaborate. Gene Kelly and Barbara Streisand did not get along.
I can definitely see that.
And part of the whole late 60s is littered with studios chasing the dragon of The Sound of Music, basically.
Yeah. Sure.
You're spending all this money on these musicals. So Hello Dolly, huge Broadway hit. Part of the deal of them making the movie was they couldn't release the movie until the Broadway show closed. So the
that, like, still running.
So after all the nightmare of getting it made, they had to sit on it for like another 2 years or something.
Whoa.
And pay interest on all this of a movie they couldn't make any money off of yet because they were contractually bound to wait until the Broadway show closed.
Well, then there's the reverse of that. There's been more of the bad tidings, like The Bourne Identity had a lot of bad news going into it and turned out not only to be a really strong first film, but a really interesting franchise until the last one, which was terrible.
Well, sure, yes.
Don't go see it. You're fine.
And, you know, and a movie that none of us particularly liked, but Bohemian Rhapsody, for its well-publicized director departure and replacement, you know, won a bunch of Oscars. So, you know.
A lot of the Marvel movies, actually, there's always hints about how, like, especially any time.
So much at stake, so many people.
Right. Yeah.
And I always find them really snide, this kind of commentary. But anytime they bring in, like, a Ryan Coogler or Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, like, anytime there's a first-timers at the helm, that's when it's, they're way over their heads, such a problem, blah, blah. I'm like, they're in the machine, man.
Yeah, it's
they're in
good
hands. You brought up.
Oh. Well, I was going to say off of that, it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't with, you know, being the fresh blood, because everybody's like, we want fresh blood to sort of mix up
right.
with this big franchise. But then, of course, they have no ground to stand on to get their artistic
vision
out.
You got your fresh blood all over my franchise.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I was saying before we started recording that Solo was, you know, this example.
Lord and Miller again.
Lord and Miller. Just let them have fun, guys. Like, let them. They just like to have fun, but that being, you know, of course, like historically troubled and how people were so invested in that throughout the entire course. And, you know, I'd like to see a petition where we, you know, are signing to see Lord and Miller's version of it instead of the end
That's
of
true.
Game
I'd
of Thrones
that.
Being reworked or The Last Jedi or whatever.
I have a friend who works in effects, and whenever this subject comes up, you can guarantee at some point he will say, it's not reshoots. It's additional photography.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That stuff's in the budget
That's
from the start.
That's somebody in pain. That's somebody who's hurt.
there's not enough additional photography in the world to rescue Men in Black International. So what do we think? Should people screen it, stream it, or skip it?
I'm going to say stream it.
Okay.
Because it's not unwatchable. Mm-hmm. And if you are the kind of person that it likes general action movies like this that are, you know, family friendly, I guess, you know, just very broad appealing, then I think that you could kill a Sunday afternoon, you know, putting away your laundry, watching Men in Black International on Netflix.
I would also be a stream it. I found as much as it was a rudimentary plot, it made it less. A lot of times they go the other way and it's real convoluted.
Yeah.
So this, I was like, oh yeah, they're doing A to B to C. Got it.
And then
I'm just enjoying people that I like. And I did find some of the alien inventions kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And I liked Kumail as Pawnee. So
I liked Kumail as Pawnee too. And maybe. Also, I mean, Hemsworth can get it.
Well, yeah,
he's very yummy.
Thank you for the shirtless shot.
They did. They had a lingering shirtless shot, which is now probably required. It's part of his contract.
Well, they did it early on, which reminded me of like when, you know, Kate Beckinsale takes a shower at the beginning of Whiteout because she's going to be in a parka for the rest of the film.
Right.
I'm saying skip it. I paid to see this movie after the initial awful reviews, but a couple critics that I trust, including one that I'm married to, were like, it's nothing great, but it's entertaining, it's breezy, and you know, the two of them are really charming. And I thought, okay, great, breezy, entertaining, the two of them are charming, I'm down for that. And I bored the snot out of me. Mm. So yeah.
And he's not spoken to Dave White since.
Cannot endorse. So we'll be back to answer a question from the Who Shot line after this message from another Maximum Fun show.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the host of Everything's Coming Up Simpsons. Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D-, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point had been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, smell you later.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm Alonzo Duraldi, and the studio with me today are...
Julia Prescott.
Drea Clark.
And now let's take a call from the Who Shot line.
Hello, folks. This is Alan from Savannah. Thank you guys so much for doing this show every week. I'm proud to be a donor. My question's a two-parter. One, what is your favorite movie poster art? Two, what's your least favorite movie poster art? This can be an individual movie or a genre. My example, I love classic James Bond artwork. Ironically, I hate the James Bond DVD covers. I love you guys. Thank you again. Bye.
Well, thank you for calling, and thank you for being a donor.
You sound adorable. If you need a mother, I'm available.
My gosh. I feel like
that's such a good question.
He wrote out the script of what he wanted to say.
It was such a good question.
Well, we pressure them to keep it short. So
yes.
Alan is no fool.
I love it.
That was good.
Oh golly, favorite posters.
I got one.
Go please.
Shoot.
Saul Bass posters.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Every day, all day.
Yes.
110%. When I was in high school, I had a giant Vertigo poster in my bedroom.
Oh, that's one of the best.
And it is one of the best. And I'm going to be honest, and I'm sorry to people in this room, Vertigo is not my favorite.
I feel you.
Yes, yeah. Not my favorite, but that postered though.
Oh yeah. Hell yeah.
That poster.
And
though.
The Anatomy of a Murder one that he did is also really well. All
when
of his
when
work.
I win the lottery, I'm getting a Bonjour Tristesse one sheet.
Oh my god, that is the most Alonzo Duralde answer. Holy shit.
It's so best.
One of my favorite posters was they did a poster for Fargo, and it was the print of like so a body laying face down in the snow with blood coming out of it, but it was all graphic design, like it was cross-stitched.
Oh, yes.
And
I loved that.
I was like, oh, this nailed it. Like, the hominess of the needlepoint.
They're
and
so great.
And the blood and the... And, yeah,
I call them my double
work.
Puppies.
Double poppies.
I bow to them.
Yeah. No, yeah. The Fargo one was so good.
This is a movie that a lot of people probably maybe don't know, but it's a favorite of mine.
And you're going to say it?
Wow. I know, go figure. And I love the poster. There is an early 80s movie from one of my favorite directors on earth, Gillian Armstrong, and it's called Starstruck. And it is, she made her bones internationally with this movie called My Brilliant Career. It was like Judy Davis's breakthrough movie. It's very tweety. It's very turn of the century. And, you know, like, yeah, it's a wonderful movie, but it's very, you know, like, yes, it's in the country and rich people having tea and that sort of thing.
I love it.
So then her next movie is completely different. It was this like wild, like pop art, like, you know, new wave, brightly colored rock music musical about a girl, you know, trying to like break into the business. And the poster is just this girl who has like orange hair piled up to the sky. She is wearing like a blue satin gown with all these like tulle tutus on it. And it is just so vibrant and like 1982 kind of new wave iconography. And it just says, from the director of My Brilliant Career, a different kind of Australian film.
That's
just one of my favorite posters ever. And if you've never seen the movie, oh my God, Starstruck is so great.
All right. I like that. I like things that have graphic quality is stupid because it's literally graphics
that we're talking about. Yeah.
Visual pop.
Yeah, visual pop. Mm-hmm. One of the ones that I always remember, maybe because it was on people's like dorm rooms, but the Silence of the Lambs poster
that had
the moth over her mouth. Yeah, yeah. And that it's really effective. It's one of the few, a lot of the ones that I bet we'll talk about are not necessarily posters that have like the actors' faces on them,
which is
what most distributors push people for, but it limits the kind of design work you can do. And that was one that it's like Jodie Foster front and center, but it tied into the story. It has a creepy quality, and even like the kind of moth it is, there's like a skull. So it's both the actor's face, but also that graphic quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember seeing that like on the front of like at Blockbuster on like VHS tape. Like, I hadn't seen Silence of the Lambs as a kid because I was scared of scary movies. But seeing that next to things like Dead Alive and like other, you know, sort of horror genre, you know, movies, which all have very effective posters. But I felt I didn't know anything about the movie, but it was instantly like, this is not for me. that's not the road I go down. I'm gonna rent Drop Dead Gorgeous again.
It puts the lotion in the basket.
Oh no. And my weekend dad was like, sure, we don't need to watch anything upsetting.
This is gonna be one of those moments where me being old comes up, but I grew up reading like old school Mad Magazine. So the old like Jack Davis and Mort Drucker illustrated posters, I really love. And if you Google, you'll see what I'm talking about. Like the Bad News Bears poster.
Yeah. Right, you're right.
You know,
yeah,
the Long Goodbye poster. Yes. It's a Mad World.
Yes.
You know,
a little
bananas.
Bit Animal House, maybe?
No, that's somebody else, but it's along
but
those lines.
It's like an illustration of it.
I love the actor in character.
Yeah, I mean, the original American Graffiti poster was Mort Drucker,
who
had that way of drawing celebrities where they looked more like themselves than they did in real life. Like, I look at Paul Newman at certain angles, it's like, oh, that's how Mort Drucker would draw
hilarious.
Paul Newman, you know.
Well, that actually segues me into my least favorite, because like we're talking about, people don't always, when you're marketing something, in most cases, the distributor's like, I'd like the stars that I paid all this money for on the box. And unless you have really interesting illustrators or designers who are like, all right, we're going to leave Anthony Hopkins entirely off of this. The worst cases of posters to me are ones where, and also as someone who's a connoisseur and creator of terrible Photoshop myself, are the posters where they've tried to put an ensemble of people.
And they were not
and
together.
And they were very clearly not together. Yes. And those drive me bad. Again, as someone, I create those. Like, I can make a bad Photoshop. So someone making this poster should be able to do better than I can do.
That's similar to my least favorite, too. I was going to say the Love Actually style of movie poster.
Ooh, like the tiled?
Yeah, tiled. Yeah, Love Actually itself, that poster, is not necessarily bad, but then it sparked a trend of this strip and tile and, like, solid color background and the and it's usually like rom-coms or like Bible movies where it's like
face,
like to give a heart, you know, or like something weird. You're like, okay, is everybody? And then they of course have like the star that's the biggest star but the least amount in the movie, like front and center.
And
And I will also say if we can include, which I'm not sure, but it's because it's always changing, but like the Netflix cover art is always
they
just
choose those
astonishingly.
That's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Well, the tile kind of reminds me of one of my least favorite things, which is in the 70s when you would have, or late 60s, but definitely in the 70s, especially in disaster movies, when they had the all-star cast and they'd have the row of boxes along the bottom of the poster.
Yeah.
So like, here's everybody who's in the swarm, you know.
Though I don't mind that as much as I, for some reason, as you were talking, I thought of like, in the 80s, the trend, and I guess the 90s, the trend of like, if it was like a goofy family comedy and, you know, it's, for lack of a better example, Ghost Dad, you know, Ghost Dad is peeking out of the corner, like the whole trend of peeking out of the corner, like what's
The 80s thing that always drove me nuts, and Brett Ehrlich, back when there was the Rotten Tomatoes show on Current, did a brilliant song about this in which he refers to the practice of shade tipping. Which is where you take your sunglasses down to the bottom of your nose.
Yes.
That became so ubiquitous on movie posters and video boxes.
I can see it. Like, it's the sure thing one.
Uh-huh.
Shade
tipping. That is my least favorite thing on a movie.
The actual poster that's my least favorite, and I think is famously one of the worst, is the Photoshop thing. And it's also, it bothers me because it's trying to recreate with the gender switch a very famous photograph. So it's for the motion picture Good Luck Chuck, starring Dane Cook and Jessica Alba, and they do an inverse.
Simpson, wasn't it?
No, this
Alba?
One.
Okay.
That's a
employee of the month.
I was like, monthly
the
employee.
Costco movie.
Yeah, no, this one, Good Luck Chuck. It's a recreation, but they're swapped of the John Lennon and Yoko Ono, where she's naked and he's holding on to her.
God.
Anyway, they do a version of that and it's clear, it's like not their bodies. The bodies don't line up. They're like shot at different times of day across the world. Like, it's the worst thing I've ever seen. I hate everything about it.
Can I add one more to that pile?
Please.
If we're talking shitty rom-coms, and this I feel like is the most egregious that I'm certain has been written about in like film texts, but the like back of a woman, you don't see her head.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a whole Twitter called like Headless Woman.
Headless Woman.
For movie
I may
posters.
Have seen it. But that to me is like, what are you doing? It is so blatantly like we're just using sex to
anything sell. Shot between two women's legs.
I was going to say, the For Your Eyes Only poster, they did it first and it was like kind of interesting, but then everybody else did it and it was gross.
Yeah.
Well, Alan from Savannah, very good question.
Thank you
for asking. And it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie, in theaters, streaming, what have you. Who would like to start?
I'll start.
Of course you will.
I have a film that I programmed for Bentonville this year that's coming out nationally this week. It's called Wild Rose, and it's wonderful. It's a Scottish film. It stars Jesse Buckley, Julie Walters, and Sophie Okonedo. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Sophie Okonedo? And it's amazing. It's about a young woman, troubled woman in Scotland, whose biggest goal in life is to become a country western singer. Mm. And she's obsessed with American country American country music, and she wants to end up in Nashville and all that. However, she's just coming out of jail, and she's very young but already has two children that her mother's been looking after. So it's a really interesting tweak of a kind of expected story of like, oh, a girl following her dreams and trying to become, and she's also an incredible singer, which makes all of it so much better because there's several performances throughout, but it has a really unique shape to it. And a lot of heart, but not in that like, oh, it's a heartwarming film.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't use primary colors for this film, but it will leave you feeling really good. And it's opening this weekend all over the place, Wild Rose, and I would check it out. I would watch it just to listen to her sing, but it's a really cool story too.
Cool.
I was trying to think what movie I've seen recently. I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about Booksmart and how great that is. That was the last theater movie that I saw that I was like, damn, guys, you better step it up. But the other night, my husband and I watched that. It's a real bummer, but it's important. The gymnast documentary that HBO did. It is, but it is, I mean, you see all the footage that went viral around the time that the court case was happening, all the women, all the victims coming forward. And like, to me, I mean, I feel like we're in this kind of golden age of documentaries that are about true crime in a different area than have been in like the 80s and 90s. And, you know, maybe that's partly because of My Favorite Murder, you know, maybe for other reasons. But I felt like this was a really great example of, you know, watching this court case sort of unfold and you know, the way that they kind of went into the backstory and, of course, had no sympathy for him as this like terrible, terrible monster. But I found characters in, you know, this documentary that I was really rooting for. And the judge at the end is like one of the most baddest women I've ever seen in my entire life. And it, for a second, if I was younger and had more options, I'd be like, maybe I should be a judge. Because she just was so tremendous in it. So that's my recommendation. It's called At the Heart of Gold. It's on HBO right now. You can watch it on the HBO Go app or catch it live. But it is not only interesting for the court case, but also just going into a deeper dive into the sport of gymnastics, which is an area I'm very hazy on. So my hats go off to all the women that enter that field. And yeah, this ending to this court case was deserved, and he will go to hell.
Yes, he will. Well, right. And that's our third sports reference.
Yeah.
Who shot you?
I know.
Sports edition.
And I can't believe I brought that.
I'm proud of you, girl.
What? I am the least sporty person.
Oh, God, can you take off that catcher's mask now,
I know.
Please?
I'm sorry.
So one of my favorite kind of underrated filmmakers, especially when we talk about like American indies of the 1970s, is the great Joan Micklyn Silver. And she directed Hester Street and Crossing Delancey. And, one of her films that I've always loved, and it's never been out on DVD that I know of, but is now finally out on Blu-ray, is a film from 1977 called Between the Lines. Mm. And it is about an indie underground newspaper in Boston that is being bought out by a large corporation. And so on the one hand, it is sort of a metaphor of the death throes of the 60s idealism. But it's also, I think, very literally about a thing that pretty much every city has endured at one point or other, where you have this kind of like, you know, anti-establishment newspaper that covers local news and arts and different stuff in an unconventional way. And then eventually somebody buys them and somebody destroys them. And, you know, so I think we've all lived through that in our lives. And this movie captures that really well. And it also has this amazing ensemble of people who weren't famous yet. So it's like Jeff Goldblum and John Hurd and Lindsay Krause and Jill Eikenberry and Bruno Kirby. Mary Lou Henner has this amazing scene where she plays a stripper and one of the guys from the newspaper is going to interview her and like all of his questions are kind of smarmy and stupid. But the woman who goes with him to take pictures has actually insightful, interesting questions and she sort of takes over the interview. Anyway, I think Joan Micklyn Silver is amazing and we don't talk about her enough as the sort of from the pre-Sundance wave of American indie pioneers. She did Chilly Scenes of Winter, also with John Hurd. But anyway, so I'm just delighted that Cohen Media just put out Between the Lines on Blu-ray. It is quite possible that you've never seen or even heard of this movie. Mm. You should.
Yeah.
All right. I'll Sounds check great. It out. I'll take that staff pick.
Yeah.
I know you hate films directed by women, but, you know.
I really do.
Try and give that a shot.
They just get their period blood all over them.
So annoying.
You know? What?
Oh, so now, 5-star reviews. We harangued you last week. Bless your hearts. You wrote some. If you leave us a 5-star review, we'll read it here on the show. Mr. Newhouse says, my producer told me to keep this review brief.
That's funny. That's
LOL.
Funny. That's legit funny.
As a new listener, adding this podcast to my weekly routine has been a delight. The hosts have great chemistry and keep the show moving at a a fun pace. I look forward each week to the friendly banter, insightful commentary, and throwbacks to cinema gems like Saving Private Benjamin. Yeah. That was Drea, not me. Keep up the good work.
The Saving Private. I said it like with such confidence, and I didn't understand why Alonzo was laughing at me. I was like, I mean, I've made some funny jokes. Why are you laughing about my Saving Private Benjamin reference? What a dork. From Fiction Mix, listen to Who Shot You? Feels like sitting down with your funniest, smartest, coolest friends to talk about the movies you've been thinking about all week. April, Drea, Ingu, RIP, Ricky, I miss you. And every guest are making a diverse and brilliant panel. And Alonzo, as a bear who loves movies myself, I feel seen. That's awesome. If you love movies, you need Who Shot Ya.
Oh, indeed you do. Thanks, y'all, for the reviews. Please keep the 5-star reviews coming. We do appreciate it. Julia Prescott, you're a delight.
Aw, thanks. You guys are delightful, too.
Where can people find you on the nets?
Well, thanks so much for asking. You can find me at Julia Prescott on all the things. And we are at Simpsons Pod for our podcast Twitter. And we mostly post on there, though we have an errant Instagram that we've forgotten about. And we release new episodes every Monday.
Right here at Maximum
Fun. Right here at Maximum Fun. And we're having fun. We're kind of going off format recently.
Really?
Just a little bit.
You're talking about Family Guy episodes?
Talking about Family Guy episodes. We're talking about, what else? Black Mirror. Anything
fish
that's really
fish Capital
police.
Critters?
Yeah. We recently talked about the album Simpsons Sing the Blues.
Ooh.
Allie had never heard it before.
What?
So it was a really fun episode where I was introducing the songs to her cold.
She never did the Bartman?
Did the Bart. Well, we talk about it. We both saw Simpsons Take the Bowl when it happened a couple years ago, and they ended the show with Do the Bartman.
Well, yeah.
As everybody in the audience was equal parts enthusiastic and livid. it was a very weird assortment of emotions.
We suddenly realized we don't know how to do the Bartman. The song
the Bartman.
Never explains it.
So that was a fun episode where we kind of go into a Simpsons deep dive, and then we still have episodes where we have special guests come on, like Simpsons writers, directors, animators, also comedians, directors, what have you, come and talk about their favorite Simpsons episodes. So, yeah.
Excellent.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
check it out, you guys. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this program, tweet at us at Who Shot Ya Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Who Shot Ya Podcast. Or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. One more time, the Who Shot line is WSY8031664. Be like Alan. Keep it brief. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This has been a production of MaximumFun.org.
Ta-da!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.